Hello.
Podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Dave Allman?
Approach and identify.
Hello.
Today, I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum. We will have a 25% tariff on foreign steel and a 10% tariff on foreign aluminum when the product comes across our borders. It's a process called dumping. The American steel aluminum industry has been ravaged by aggressive foreign trade practices. It's really an assault on our country.
From the Pac Northwest studio of the Podcast 99 Network, located in beautiful downtown Silverdale, Washington, this is Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show podcast. Now, here is your host, the submarine-qualified, well-coffeed, rules-driven, elitist history buff, Dave Bowman.
Weapons con here, permission to fire.
After permission to fire, con weapons out.
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are and whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today, most of them far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, podcasting, economics, tariffs, taxes, Trump, and all the Tims that I know, and humanity. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. Tim Preuss, you see him down there in the little window, joins me today. We'll talk about, well, whatever the hell we want to talk about for the next hour. Join us. Have some fun. Here's how you get a hold of me. Text machine, area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 565-3283. Email Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're all over the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, the web, wherever else. Even the dark web, probably there, too. E lo qui conizio, the greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. Well, good morning from the great Pacific Northwest, where the pollen level is atomic today. About an hour ago, I was clawing my eyes out. A little bit of Zyrtec and some Visine, and I'm good to go. Joining me, you see him down there in the little box, Tim Preuss from the Tim Preuss Show. Tim, welcome to the show. Good to have you with us, finally.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's, yeah, like you said, finally. It's like we've been kind of crossing, we've been two boats crossing in the night.
Two ships.
And it's about time we got together and had a conversation.
I've been looking forward to this. I've been watching Tim for, I met Tim probably a year and a half ago now. And I say met in the sense of the 21st century internet. We've never shaken hands. We've never, I couldn't tell you how tall he is. I couldn't tell you anything about him, other than what I see in the pictures and what we've talked about on Twitter and a few other places. Tim is a podcaster who started out in the state of Wisconsin, which is in the Midwest, where the real Americans live, and now has relocated to Arizona. So let's start with that. How do you go from Wisconsin in the Midwest, where the real Americans live, to Arizona, which is, I've been to Arizona, it's hot.
I moved at the right time of year. So, I mean, that's for sure, because I moved in the beginning of January. So when I left, it was, you know, negative degrees. And then when I got down here, it was sunny and it's 75.
Yeah,
so I haven't really had a chance to experience the totally blistering, you know, Valley of the Sun heat yet. That's a couple months away. And how did I get here? A 30-hour drive.
Why?
30 hours. I didn't stop at all. And I mean, except for gas and a lot of Monster energy drinks.
Right. Which are bad for you. You know that, right?
Yeah, of course I know that. Yeah, but so is crashing.
I'm just checking. I'm just making sure you know these things, because I worry about you young people and your bad habits. And you don't get to be my age by doing dumb things, you know?
Yeah, I know. No, that's, I mean, I'm not a huge energy drink guy. It was just like, I need just caffeine right now or else I'm going to drive off the road. And I didn't want to stop because I had some stuff with me that, you know, just a bunch of guns.
Oh,
so it's like, I don't want to like stop and then have to move all of this stuff into a hotel room, have the receptionist at the hotel kind of look at me weird, and then, you know, take it all back out the following morning. It's like, no, I'll just push through. And it's crazy. You know, they say that we use sleep deprivation on terrorists and things like that. I know why. You start like hallucinating at a certain point, especially if you're at night. I was seeing the little red and blue lights behind me multiple times, no one else on the road.
Yep.
So it's crazy stuff.
Keep in mind, I'm the guy that when I was your age, used to drive back and forth across the country, 3,400 miles from Washington to Norfolk on a fairly regular basis. And I would do it in 2.5 days and not stop either. So been there, done that, man. And I survived.
It's fun.
It's not fun. It was fun when I was young enough to think it was fun. Now I don't even like to drive to Silverdale. It's 3 miles away. I drive to Silverdale and I get out of the car and I'm like, oh, that's too long a drive. I can't stand anymore. So how'd you get into podcasting, Tim? You didn't just roll out of bed one morning, did you? And just go, you know what? Today's the day that I unleash the Tim Preuss podcast upon the world.
No, it didn't happen that way. It was actually Josh Carter and I of the Resistance podcast. He and I have been good friends, you know, going back to, you know, probably over a decade. And whenever we would just get together, him and I, we'd always have really great conversations, whether it was over drinks or over dinner or whatever. And we said, you know, we should record these. It was soon after that that he moved about an hour and a half away. And then I said, well, I still want to start it. So I started mine. And but it started. Basically, what put the seed in my head was having good conversations with someone and saying, you know what, these conversations are constructive for us, so they might be constructive for someone else to listen to as well.
That's a pretty good place to start with it, and it's kind of unusual in today's internet world where everything is 140 characters, and how many zingers can you get in 140 characters, preferably with capital letters. That seems to be the approach to conversation today, and I tell you what, it drives me nuts.
It does to me as well. And that's why I don't even participate in a lot of Twitter stuff. I mean, I think my last little Twitter argument, I've had like one in the last 2 years, and it was, you know, months and months ago, and I don't want to have another one. So if I tweet something, I'll tweet a link to an article, but I'm not going to start bickering back and forth with people over stuff, because ultimately you're not going to change their mind. They're not going to change yours. Mm-hmm. And what's the point of that then? The audience, people who might read it after the fact, they're not really going to get a whole lot out of it. And, you know, I've seen like, you know, internet, social media battles ruin friendships. And it's, to me, that is just ridiculous. And it's a sign that maybe we should stop with so much social media and communicating with each other through a computer. And we should get back to actually having conversations and meeting people and, you know, looking in their eyes and realizing that this isn't just an avatar on the internet. This is a real person. And it's like we don't even treat people that we know on the internet as real people. There's someone else behind that computer who is reading this. And like, do you not care that this is another human? Is this the way we just decided to treat other humans, whether we agree or disagree? It's a very negative thing, I think.
Now, does that preclude, because this is always the argument with, you know, everybody wants to say what you just said because it's kumbaya. It makes us, when we all feel that way, we all feel like conversation has gotten out of control. But it seems like there's nothing we can do about it. How do we get to that point? How do we get to that nirvana of two people who disagree on something being able to have a communication, a talk about whatever it is they disagree about without having it degenerate into an argument because we're behind screens? In many cases, we're anonymous. How do we do that?
I don't know that we can, honestly, you know, especially with, you know, the people who still like real conversations. It seems like a lot of those people are dying off or they're not into the internet thing. You know, this is like kind of a medium that they're not a part of. So with the younger people, I'm not sure how you change it. Dave Rubin of the Rubin Report does a great job, and he's shown that there is still a pretty good hunger for real conversations, real long form interviews, things like that. There is a hunger for it. So it's just put it out there. And if people see it and they like it, hopefully they'll start spreading the word and more people will come to realize that this is the way people should behave.
Well, you said something interesting on Twitter today that I wanted to get into, because this speaks to something that I'm actually trying to push for, and that is this communication, this form of communication has changed. I come from a radio background. I come from a talk radio background where I spent, you know, the better part of a decade, a little more than a decade in talk radio. And that medium is designed, there's a myth that it's designed to educate, enlighten, elucidate. It's really not. It's designed to sell ads via increased ratings. So the more outrageous you can be, the more controversial you can be, the more Alex Jones you can be, you create more ratings, and that equates to more money. I've always believed, and even when I was there, I believed that a better approach is to have reasonability to this. But I can't tell you, while I went through three program managers and a couple of general managers, we spent time butting heads because that's not what they wanted. What they wanted was, and here, buy this. That drove me nuts.
Yeah.
This is,
and that's too bad. I mean, it's like, but you're absolutely right. Rate was designed to sell stuff. They want a host who can bring people in, keep them captivated, and who is passionate and really likes that person enough to buy the products that that person is pushing. I mean, you see it all the time with, you know, LifeLock and all that kind of stuff, or the weird different products that Alex Jones puts out. But the reason they can sell that stuff is because they're so rah, rah, rah.
Right.
I'm not like that. You're obviously not like that.
Well, I am.
And,
I mean, I did for a decade.
But maybe we don't, but I also don't sell products, you know,
but I
so
did.
I'm doing this purely to, right, as a hobby for myself, a little bit of income here and there comes in. And because I enjoy it.
Right. And that's what I'm trying to do, not only with the podcast, which I've been doing now since I left radio, but now that we've launched the radio station, the internet radio station, I'm finding it surprisingly difficult to find people who want to talk about what they're passionate about in a reasonable way. They want to yell, but you can only maintain the yelling for 5-10 minutes before it gets old and repetitive. And I'm finding it surprisingly difficult to find people who can hold a conversation about something for a long time, for an hour.
Yeah. I think, it's a book called The Shallows, and it talks about what the internet has done to our brains. Ugh. And we've actually like changed them. Mm-hmm. They can change back, but a lot of the pathways, the neural pathways, when we read blogs, when we do Twitter, all this kind of stuff, it's very back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You look for the one fact that you want, you find it, copy paste, done, as opposed to just reading an entire article. People don't do that anymore, and it's changing the way we can actually keep attention. So I think that's just, this is kind of a natural, you know, it's a kind of a cause and effect thing, that our brains are changing and people can't even read books, where they might be able to sit down and read it. But after a certain point, you realize, I just read three pages that I didn't even read.
Yeah.
Like, I read the words, but I wasn't paying attention to them at all. And this is happening more and more. And I think that some of the stuff we're seeing where, yeah, people can't have conversations, that's a natural result of our brains actually being rewired. The good thing is that our brains are relatively, you can change them over time. So although we might have been using a certain neural pathway a lot, we can start using another one, and our brains will go to that other one in time. And you have to retrain your brain to read more, read for longer periods of time, and then have more, you know, have longer conversations. And I think in time we can get back there if people actually want to do it.
Yeah, I've had that conversation a couple of times today. A good friend of mine, Brian Brody from Unleash Your Legendary show, was talking this morning about he doesn't use social media before sunrise. Now, that sounds kind of silly to me because I don't get up until 7:30, but Brian gets up, you know, 3:30 and god awful early in the morning. So for him, that's almost three hours that he gets up before he actually looks at that. And then I was thinking, and I was talking the other day to him about some other issues, but I as disappointed as I was that Josh and Bryce no longer do the Resistance podcast, I have the utmost respect for why he's doing that, because he wants to spend more time with his family, with his child, but in books as well. And you can see that in his social media has become almost exclusively what I'm reading now and what I'm learning now. And I do have a lot of respect for that. I miss his show, but I have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed when I found out he wasn't going to be doing it anymore. And oh, no, darn it. Like, I feel like a lot of the people who kind of came in with me and that I knew from the start, they're leaving podcasting. And I'm going to be like one of the only guys who's been around for a decent period of time, which on one hand, it's like, yeah, good for me. Pat on my back.
Right.
But you're right. Josh is doing it for the right reasons, because he realizes how ugly and how divisive social media can be. And instead he said, I know what, I'm done with this. I need a break from this. This is ridiculous. He wants to focus on something that I think is 10 times more important. That's his actual family, his kids and his wife.
Right.
And then whatever free time he has, he'll take it and use it for reading and learning something new. And more people should probably do that. You know, we live in a world where people are having dinner across from each other, but they're both looking at their phones and they're not talking. Why are you even in the same room? Why do you live together? You know, why are you having dinner together if you're not actually engaging with the person that's there with you?
You know what my question to that is why do we have these damn phones if nobody's ever going to answer them? Everybody just texts. Nobody ever talks to anybody anymore. You said something on Twitter, though, this morning that caught my attention, because, again, with what I'm trying to do with the radio station and everything else here, you were talking about Netflix and television. You kind of want to. Can you kind of run through that this morning and what led to that comment?
I said Netflix are TV and that have basically taken over TV, and podcasts are going to take over radio. And I didn't mean necessarily as a full replacement, but that there are so many people out there now who don't even subscribe to any cable providers. They just watch Netflix or they watch Hulu, or, you know, that's where they get their stuff from. And there's a lot of free internet TV. Where you can watch live RT, you can watch live CBS News, and it's all free, all just over the internet. So that's the direction television has shifted. And podcasts are kind of the same way with audio. And if you look at some of the numbers of the top podcasters, I mean, everyone says, oh, Rush Limbaugh is number one. No, not even close. You know, Rush is doing, what, around 20 million listeners a week. Joe Rogan has 20 million downloads per episode, you know, so he's crushing him. And it's more on demand.
Right.
Netflix on demand, podcasts on demand. Netflix, you can pause. Podcasts, you can pause. But you can't do that stuff with old school television and terrestrial radio. So I think that's the way things are shifting. And people like that. People like the ability to pick and choose what they want to watch and what they want to listen to. And you don't really have as much choice with TV and radio. It's also part of the kind of instant gratification that's been very, very prevalent in the last few decades, where people say, I want to listen to this now. I don't want to wait till the afternoon to listen to Rush Limbaugh. I want to listen to some conservative talking head now. And now you have that option.
My on-air partner and I, John, were talking about this some time ago, about the fact that Netflix has changed how we watch television, and even on-demand TV. I mean, I have regular satellite DirecTV, and I have three or four shows that I really like, but I won't watch them when they come on, when they premiere. The Detour is a good example. I love the show The Detour. I won't watch it until there's five episodes built up, because you're right. I want it. Not only do I want it when I want it, but I want as much of it as I can take, as opposed to 30 minutes, let's go away and you know, wait a week for it. I've gotten to the point where I hate that. And I grew up, Tim, I grew up when we had black and white televisions with three stations and a PBS channel. And you changed it with your hand. I remember that. This is my life. And now I'm like, no, if I don't have five of them and I can't, and I have to get out of my seat, I'm not going to watch it.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing. And actually what spurred my tweet last night was I was watching a Ricky Gervais special on Netflix, and he said that exact thing, where Netflix is TV, and how he doesn't watch television anymore. If he does, he'll record stuff and he'll wait. Like you said, you'll wait till you build up five or six episodes and then binge watch them all. But you're not going to watch one at a time. Who does that? Yeah, it's just a cultural shift and a change in technology. And but I think that's the way to go. Radio is great. I love radio. I love talk radio. That's how I started realizing I didn't even know what podcasts were for a long time. And then I started listening. I'm like, this is a great format. And especially when you can get away from the FCC and the different regulations, you can get away from a time clock. All of that kind of stuff.
And you can get away from general managers and program directors. And now I'm running my own internet radio station, which has its advantages, like you said, FCC. But now I'm the general manager and program director again. So I'm have to yell at myself when I'm not doing so. My goal here is, you're right about podcasting. I love podcasting. What I don't like, and this is my own preference, I don't like overproduced stuff. I like the live show, which is one of the reasons why I've gone back to a live show that then I turn into a podcast, because it's, to me, it's just a better way of doing it. I don't like the overly produced stuff, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. I agree. And even with my show, although, you know, it's not done live, there's very little editing that I do. Mm-hmm. It's only if, like, oh crap, I'm in the middle of recording and I have to use the bathroom, then I'll actually stop back in and blah, and no one will know. But I do very, very little editing as far as what did I say? Did I pronounce something wrong? Was there an awkward pause? Something like, I don't edit any of that stuff out, because part of what makes it feel real and authentic is that liveness. And if it's a podcast, you just have to do it off the cuff to try to kind of replicate a little bit of what talk radio offers.
And I do think that there's something to that, that old feeling of I Love Lucy or Milton Berle. You know, everybody in the country was tuned in at 6 p.m. on Thursdays, and you knew everybody was doing it. And that's one of the reasons why I like the live radio feel to it. And then you can always turn it into a podcast. Buster's on the chat. He says, all these channels and nothing on. It was a bit more interesting with three channels and UHF. But then again, I was a lot younger, and I was too. All right. So that's what we're doing. That's how we've done it. That's where we've got there. Tim is getting ready to relaunch his show. Like I said, it was up in Wisconsin, which is in the Midwest, which where the real Americans live. He's getting ready to relaunch the show. Kind of talk about that for a moment.
Well, since I moved, I moved down here, like I said, beginning of January, and for about a month, I didn't have a house. I was just kind of shacking up with a friend. I can't set a studio up in his apartment. It's a two-bedroom apartment. There's nowhere to put a studio. Plus, all of my stuff was in storage. So I came down here, had to find a place to live. Eventually found one, like I said, about a month after I got here. Then I had to call the moving company and said, hey, get my stuff out of storage and bring it down here. Finally, about, you know, a month after that, it arrives at my door. Well, my studio isn't in my house. So then I have to move all the podcast gear from my house to the standalone studio, which is where I am now. And I said March 19th, that should be a reasonable date. That way people know when it's actually going to be. And it's Monday through Friday. It's an hour every day. And I'm excited to be back at it, because I miss talking into a microphone. I miss talking with other people. I miss ranting, because I do love to do that on occasion. I also like laughing. And it's like, yeah. Podcasting was a really fun part of my life, and it had to take a little brief hiatus, but it's back and I'm really excited about it.
This sounds so familiar to me, just a year apart. I mean, we moved down here. We shut down the show there. We moved down here, stayed with my brother-in-law for a month, got a house. The difference is I bought a house big enough with a room. Now I have a studio in my house. All I got to do is come up here, and I mean, my coffee machine is, 15 feet away. All I got to do is go down the stairs and in the kitchen. But otherwise it sounds very familiar, and then you get ready to kick up and then get ready to go again. So Tim is, if you had to describe yourself, this is one of the things I used to laugh about with Josh and Bryce. Every time I'd go on their show or they'd be on my show or whatever, they always had these labels: anarcho-capitalist, socialist, meaning Baptist, whatever. They always had these labels of what they were. And I always used to kind of giggle about that, because I have no idea what the hell I am. I mean, I know what I am, but I don't know what they put in their language. So if you had to describe yourself and your podcast, what would you label it?
Oh, that's a good one. I don't know. I'd say just ask me my opinion on any topic and I'll tell you it. And if I don't have an opinion, I'll say I don't know enough. Maybe some sort of a libertarian. Some people would say, oh, he's just a straight up anarchist. To some people, I'm just a right wing conservative guy. But any of those, I'm very for human liberty and allowing people to live their own lives, make their own choices. I'm very pro Second Amendment. I am pro securing the border. I'm anti welfare. I'm anti warfare, though. A lot of those things. So I'm against abortion. I'm okay with gay marriage. And I'm pro free market. That's the big one. Is I got into economics long before I got into politics. And so that's kind of my starting place, is what are the economic implications of this policy? Whether it's good politics or not, I care about the economics of it first, most of the time.
So let's start there then. There's actually two topics that I want to get into, and either one of those could be a lead in, but let's start with that one. We started talking last week about the issues with tariffs. Now, We heard Donald Trump there at the beginning of the show talking about national security. That's why we're doing this tariff, is the reason for that. I spent a good deal of time last week on one of my shows talking about tariffs as national policies. And my conclusion was very simple, Tim, and that was there are good points to them. There are bad points to them. It really depends on what the end goal of the tariff is. I don't know what the end goal of this tariff is. I can't figure that out.
I suppose the end goal is to encourage manufacturers within the United States to use domestic steel and aluminum and not foreign steel and aluminum. And that'll, you know, theoretically, it'll help people who work in the steel and aluminum business in America. On the other hand, it means that all those manufacturers are going to have to pay more for their steel and aluminum, and therefore all their consumer products are going to cost more and will hence be less competitive on the world market. So I'm not sure what the end goal really is. If it's just to help union members in the steel and aluminum business, no, because it's going to, I don't like it. And it's funny that this is politics versus economics. Virtually every economist, going back all the way to Adam Smith, has agreed that tariffs aren't really a great idea, economically speaking. Politicians are the ones who try to push them, but that's usually just to benefit one group at the expense of another. That one group will see an immediate effect, and you can point to it and say, yes, that helped. But the people who see the negative effect, it happens down the road. It's a little bit on each person, so it's spread out. These people don't have lobbyists, so you don't really hear them complain. And most of the time, if they notice that, you know, the price of cars goes up, they're not going to correctly attribute that to tariffs. So it's a wonderful political policy. All the positives are seen and immediate. All the negatives are unseen, and they take a few years.
But there is a national, as you said, there is a national policy. There's a national benefit here. When we look at things like the tariff of 1816, what you said there about, you know, forcing or compelling or encouraging U.S. manufacturers to use our steel. In 1816, we were trying to, that's one of the things that they said was, we're trying to compel American manufacturing to become a force. And it worked insofar as we began to build stuff, make stuff, and quit buying English and French goods. But the trade-off was, like you said, the end user kind of got screwed over. And when the end users 4 years later realized that there was no real national security interest here, they got a little pissy about it. And we all know what happens when Southerners get pissy about things, especially in the 1820s and 1830s. So is there a similar scenario here? Again, the president says this is about national security, but I don't see the national security interest in Syria. How the hell is this a national security interest? What is China doing that's causing us a national security interest?
Nothing.
That's
nothing.
What I thought.
But I think perhaps the way the law is written is that the president can only just put these tariffs into place on his own if he deems it a national security interest kind of thing.
Because of the
otherwise, Congress would have to do it, and Congress won't do it because Democrats and Republicans, by and large, don't like these. So in order for Donald Trump to act unilaterally, he had to label it national security. But I don't think he believes that. I mean, please. And if he thinks that this is going to give some giant jobs boost and economic boost to America as a whole, I mean, Donald Trump isn't stupid. This is politics, but it has nothing to do with national security.
Well, and of course, the law is written so that if we are in a state of war, the president can put on tariffs. Well, we're kind of in a state of war, even though we haven't declared it. We have this unending AMF, authorization for the use of military force. So theoretically, the president, whomever it might be, it's not necessarily Trump, whomever it is, can just start tariffing everything in the name of national security. And we, the public, are just going to go wave our flags and say, national security, here it is. And I'm the hawk here, folks. I'm the guy that is ready to nuke Afghanistan 15, 18 years ago. So don't say that I'm, you know, not pro whatever that kind of nonsense is, but it seems like we've overreached here and we've really allowed the executive branch an open door when it comes to this kind of thing. And that bothers me.
Oh, absolutely. It bothers me, too. And the reason that the executive branch is doing all these things is because Congress has just abdicated. They're doing their job. Abdication of duty. I'd say fire all of Congress. I don't know what they're doing. They haven't even passed a budget in over a decade. You know, like, this is basic stuff. They don't do their jobs. And their job is a lot of the time to be a check and a counterbalance to whatever the executive branch is doing. And Congress doesn't seem to see themselves that way. They see themselves as the helpers of the president, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. They all have abdicated their duty, and they should be fired for it.
Yeah, but who are you going to replace them with?
Like you said, the reason we have this tariff is because we've been in unending wars, and they're not even declared. Congress hasn't declared a war since World War II.
Right, but they don't have to. They don't. See, that's the thing you young folk don't understand, because you weren't around during Nixon. The War Powers Act, they don't have to declare war anymore. They have essentially, they did exactly what they did in 1801, which is they put it on the president. If the president finds that, blah, 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 a state of war exists, then we can seize these cargoes. Well, they've done the same thing with the War Powers Act in 73, which was if the president deems the national security at risk, he can send in the Army, send in the Navy, send in the Marines, fight a war for 90 days, and at the end of 90 days, we'll give our approval or disapproval 3 months after the war has started. Nixon vetoed that. He said, this is not constitutional. Dick Nixon vetoed that. The same guy that, you know, Watergate and everybody thinks is a bad guy. He vetoed that as unconstitutional. Congress overrode him. Congress has gone out of its way to slough off its duties onto the executive so that it can stand there and go, well, that president's doing something we don't like. Well, who the hell cares if you don't like it? You're the one letting him do it, morons.
I agree 100%. You know, but even with the War Powers Act, we're still talking 90 days. We've been in there for 17 years.
But what happened at the end of 90 days? They passed an authorization for use of military force that basically said, you know, you've seen those bumper stickers on people. I saw one yesterday, the little yellow sticker, terrorist hunting licenses. I mean, that's what it is. That's what the 2001 and 2003 OMS are. They're terrorist hunting license. You declare it. You find that there's a terrorist. Go get him.
Go get him anywhere in the world, no matter what rock he's hiding under. And no matter which of us are here and which of us aren't here. I think maybe at the very least, we should have to have a new authorization of the use of force every 2 years when there's new members of Congress in. I mean, we've gone multiple presidents that are using the same authorization for the use of force. What's going on here? It's because Congress is too lazy to do it again. And they know that if they did authorize more force again, then they might get, booted out of there, because people by and large are sick of the war. So they don't know why we're there anymore. In the beginning, it was saying, these are the guys that took down the Twin Towers, and you could point at them and say, you have to go take on Al-Qaeda. You have to go take on the Taliban. Who are we fighting now? And how is it a threat to us? And why are we in Africa, you know, now in Niger?
Out of 54
and they said,
countries.
Oh, we had soldiers that were killed in Niger. And all of the war hawks were outraged, and they said, you're right, we need more soldiers in Niger. They didn't even know that we were there in the first place. Who did?
I knew that there was military presence in Africa, but I was stunned when I was reading the report that 53 out of 54 African countries have a American military presence in them. Why? Most Americans couldn't find Niger. They couldn't pronounce Niger properly if you let them do it. And where is it? Nobody knows. We have troops in Mauritania, for God's sake. Why? Because there's terrorists there, supposedly.
Supposedly. And I think that it was a brilliant thing for George Bush to call it the war on terror, because terror is everywhere at all times, all places. It's wonderful. It's never ending. You'll never be able to completely get rid of terror. Therefore, you'll never really end this war. It's wonderful for people who just love war. They love the supposed benefits that it brings the economy, or at least certain people, certain industries in the economy. They love that stuff. But I think the American people are done with it. They don't know why we're there anymore. And they can't pronounce, they can't locate most of the countries we're in. We have over 900 bases in over 100 countries. And then they keep clamoring and saying, well, you know, our national defense has been hollowed out over the last, since the sequester. The sequester wasn't a cut in spending on the military. The sequester was a cut in the rate of growth. You know, so they're getting more and more each year. They're just not getting as much more as they would prefer. Well, that's not a cut. I mean, and the thing that you're spending $600 billion and it's being hollowed out. Well, then it sounds like you're spending that money in the wrong places.
It's not a cut. I agree with you there. It's a cut in baseline expansions. But when you're dealing with technology that's advancing as fast as military technology is and as expensive as it is, I saw a report the other day, the Columbia class SSBNs, $100 billion before the first one slides down the ways at EB. That's a difference. I mean, my submarine cost $8 billion. So, and that was 40 years ago. So, and we're still using her. She's in bad shape from what I don't know this. I have no direct knowledge, but I'm told by people who I believe this thing's going to have to be replaced soon. The newest one of our submarines of that era was commissioned in 1997. So, we need to replace these ships, but the cost, the expense, and apparently the Chinese steel tariffs are going to make it cost more now. So while it may not be a cut per se, it's not necessarily the necessary increase to maintain the equipment that we have. Now, that doesn't change the fact that some of this stuff is, you know, overspending. The F-35 is ridiculous, but, you know, the way they do that is they build little components of it in basically every congressional district in the country, and that way they can't cut it because then Congressman Flapjack can say, look what I got you for you. Look at the jobs I brought home. And if you cut this, four people in my district are going to lose their job and we can't have that.
Pissed yeah. And it's interesting that the military technology gets more and more expensive, but I don't know. Computers are getting less expensive. TVs are getting less expensive. Furniture is getting less expensive. But,
yeah, but you don't build
one thing that almost only the government buys keeps getting more and more and more expensive. I mean, this is, again, the difference between what government does and what the free market does. Free market will deliver you better products, faster products, cheaper products, but better quality products. And government product, well, maybe the technology is better. I would hope that it's better. But the expenses of it just keep rising and rising and rising. And it's because it's not a free market.
Well, and I grant you that, but I can speak for myself. I can't speak for anybody else, but I'm not getting into a free market built submarine. I'm just not doing it. I want a subsafe submarine that's built under the proper program before I go underwater in it. That's where I'm at on that. So, I you know, while I agree in free markets, there are some things. I mean, constitutionally, it says right there in Article 1, build and maintain a Navy. So that is a government responsibility, and I want the government doing that one.
No, absolutely. I'm not saying let's have a privatized military or anything like that, but perhaps some more competition in these kinds of purchases.
Right,
like let's have a few companies design a submarine. Let's see who can build it the fastest, who can build the most of them, and let's see who can build it for the cheapest, as opposed to just giving a contract based on someone's political district or something like that.
Right.
We could try to incorporate some free market principles into the way we use our military dollars.
I mean, they do put these things out to bid. I mean, there were three different companies that bid on the new boomers, but at the end of the day, you're almost forced to go with one of two of them because they're the only two that actually have, what's the word? Oh, yeah, experience building these things. And what we've seen with some of the other ships, the LCS class frigates now is what they're calling them, these idiot catamaran ships, trimaran ships that keep breaking down, the new Zumwalt destroyers that, you know, we put out there with all that fanfare and it breaks down in the middle of the Panama Canal. The Coronado was over in the Philippines or Bangkok or somewhere over there for 6 months because they couldn't get the damn thing running. That's what happens when you get too far outside of that's where you get too far outside of experience in all of this based on two things. One, congressional districts. Hey, I want this built in my district, and a little bit too much in things that I'm a free market guy with you, but there are some things I think that need to remain within the realm of who does this best and longest. And I wouldn't trust a pastor who's only been a pastor for a week. What, you know, why would I trust somebody that's building ships that's never done it before?
Well, I don't know why you would. But I do know that competition will make everyone better, and I want more competition because I want a better submarine and I want a cheaper submarine. And if we can get both of those, then, and I think it is doable if we got the politics out of it. If we got politicians out of this,
yeah,
and like I said, incorporate some market principles into the process, then we could perhaps get new submarines that don't cost us $600 billion. I mean, and the other thing to think about is, well, China has submarines, right? The UK has submarines. Russia has submarines. Why are we spending so much more than all of these other countries combined?
Because they suck. That's why. And you want to win.
We're not at war with any of them. You know,
not today, no. But you don't plan for the war you're in. You plan for the next one. So, yes, China has submarines. For the most part, they're technologically kludge. They're what you would call second-generation submarines. They're not great. England, you're right, has submarines, but if you're following the news, they have a lot of them tied up to the pier right now because they can't maintain them. Germany, Deutschland Uber Allies, the U-boat people, they have a submarine fleet that not one of which right now is seaworthy. Every one of them is tied up to a pier right now because they can't maintain them.
Right, and none of those countries are really at war. So, I mean, does it leave them, you know, unprepared for another war? I don't know. How long could we get a submarine if we needed it? If we needed it tomorrow, how long would it take to call someone up and say, build this for me at this spec? But, you know, with our budget the way it is, we need to do something about our spending. And military is one aspect of that. But another aspect is the entitlements. And that's something that both parties and presidents for as long as, you know, these entitlements have existed, have refused to cut. And we need to do something about that. Right. As a portion of GDP, military is actually going to shrink as a share of GDP as we go a decade out, two decades out. But entitlements grow and grow and grow. So for a long-term solution, military cutting, it's not going to solve it. We have to tackle the big ones, and that's Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the big problem with that is that represents not just votes. There's this constant argument about illegal immigration and welfare folks. It's votes. They vote their wallet. It's not even the votes. It's the registrations, because that's what affects apportionment when they start doing those things. And that's how they maintain their control in districts that are, even in California, gerrymandered to a degree based on registration. So you start cutting those entitlements while people stop registering, they stop participating in the political process. And boy, that's what scares politicians. You lose that kind of support. You lose that kind of income that they're going to get from that. It's a mess. I mean, this whole thing, I don't know how you change it. I really don't.
Unfortunately, I don't either. I don't think you really can. It's not politically feasible to do the kinds of things that we need to do. So, you know, I don't know if this country goes off a cliff, has a dollar crisis, inflation spins out of control. People say, hey, where's my money? I want to cash in this government bond, and there's nothing left to pay for it with. So we just end up printing the money. We don't know what's going to happen. We're in uncharted waters right now.
That's the argument right now. The Keynesian argument is, well, there will always be something to pay for it. And to a degree, see, I have this argument with California all the time. California has $140 billion in debt that they're not addressing. And I used to get in trouble as a conservative on talk radio because I just poo-poo that. California might have $140 billion in debt, but California's got gold, oil, timber, resources out the wazoo that it won't touch because of political climate. But the day is going to come when they're going to have to pay all that, and they're going to look around and go, oh, wait, we've got oil. Wait, we've got gold. Wait, we've got resources to pay for this. So I kind of look at the country in the same way. Okay, we're a trillion, what is it, 17 trillion? You're the one that tracks this every day. What's the debt today?
I don't know what it is today. It's right around 20.5 trillion.
All right, we got 25 trillion in debt. But if you totaled up all the untapped resources that we have on an accrual basis, that balance sheet is not in that bad of position, I don't think. So I don't worry about it.
Assumes we can use all those resources to pay back the government debt. And that's the government debt.
Yeah, I agree. And that's something else most conservatives don't get, is most of our debt is to the government. Most of it is to ourselves. It's not to China. I got into it with a congressman about that one time. Well, China's doing this. We don't know China's squat compared to what we owe you because you keep doing stuff. But point being that I'm not as concerned about that. I'm not a Keynesian. I'm not, you know, crazy here. But at the same time, I also know there's an ace in the hole that nobody's talking about because they don't know about it. They don't think about it in those terms. But it But as far as getting control of this, I'm an originalist, Tim. I'm a believer that you go with the original intent. I don't want to live in 1787. For God's sake, they had slaves, and they didn't even have outhouses. They had chamber pots, for God's sake, and no showers. I'm not doing that. Okay. But the intention of what they meant to have done. And if we guided ourselves by that, and if we educated the voting electorate on those things, then maybe we'd start asking the right questions of our congresspeople that are running for Congress. Instead of asking them, you know, do you support, I don't know, getting more money for whatever industry is in my town, we could be asking them substantive issues about actual policies and constitutional issues that we're not doing. And instead of our presidential elections being about who slept with who and who grabbed who and who has what illness, we could talk about what they're actually policy going to do. Would Donald Trump have won if everybody in the country understood that he was going to put a 25% tariff on Chinese steel? Or would he have won even bigger if everyone
I
had
think understood? He might have won even bigger, because I think if you can sell tariffs very easily. I think one of the reasons he won is because Hillary Clinton was nothing. She was offering no new policies, and she was so unoriginal and boring. The only thing that was great about Hillary was that she was a woman. And Donald Trump had policies that he pushed, and people bought into them, and that's why he mopped the floor with her. So, I don't like a lot of his policies, but I think the fact that he actually has them and talks about them, that's a big reason why he won.
Yeah. Well, and I wish there was, to some degree, I wish there was more of that. I said 20 years ago, and even 15 years ago when I was on the air, we used to do a thing called Top 5, and we had a top 5 things I would do if I were president. And one of the things I said is I would cuss. As a president, I would cuss. Because I think Americans like a president who speaks from reality instead of the mishmash, mushly mouse, politically correct crap that normally comes out. And I think Donald Trump tapped into that a little bit. I think that, you know, not necessarily in cussing and bleep, bleep, this, that, and the other, but I think that he kind of captured that idea that we're tired of the politically correct nonsense. And Hillary kept trying to push that and kept trying to be that and kept trying to do those things, whereas Trump was the anti-everything in Washington. It's my angry birds theory, which is that conservatives know that Trump is not a conservative. But they're so angry at everything in Washington, D.C., they're just throwing birds at it to knock it down. And I'm
And that's too bad. You know, we've gotten to the point where we're so frustrated with how Washington operates that we're willing to just throw anything out there. He's an outsider. He's outspoken. He sleeps with a bunch of women. But he's a billionaire. He lives at the top of a skyscraper in Manhattan. This guy's awesome. I mean, you've seen him on The Apprentice saying, "You're fired." It was everyone's dream for Donald Trump to say that to Barack Obama. You know, so we've reached that point where he's entertaining, he's loud, he's bombastic, and he uses smaller words, four-letter words sometimes. and it's, you know, people so like that. He seems relatable. And, you know, I don't think that's a bad thing. My main qualm with Donald Trump is just some of his policies, not really his personality. I'm not offended by him. I don't think he needs to act more presidential or anything like that, because he has to relate to people, and people like Donald Trump by and large.
Well, I can never forgive him for one particular thing. The man could be Mother Teresa. He could save children in Africa. He could build a bridge or whatever. I don't care. He did one thing for which I can never forgive him. And that you, when were you born? I mean, that's a strange question, but
89.
So you weren't even born yet when this happened. Okay. Trump owned the New Jersey Generals of the United States Football League. Okay. I was one of the few people that really liked the USFL, and it was Donald Trump's insistence that they move to direct competition with the NFL with a fall season that killed the USFL. Donald Trump did that, you bastard. And I've hated him for that ever since. Because I loved the USFL. I really did. I'm one of about the 8 people that did. But
well, maybe that was the reason why it went away. Yeah, you try to compete with the NFL, and you have only 8 people tuning into your games.
Well,
oh, boy.
They were doing better than that in the spring, but he wanted to move them to the fall and compete directly with the NFL. And it just – we didn't want that. The fans – we had fall football. We wanted spring football, see? And – he messed
up. Yeah, well, onto some pop culture then. You hear that Vince McMahon, the owner of WWE, is restarting XFL, Extreme Football League. That's coming down the pike, too.
It didn't work last time. It's not going to work this time. And you know why? It's not going to work because of the difference in litigation and the concussion issues. How's he going to get around that? He didn't have the insurance for that.
I have no idea how he plans to do it. No idea, but it's interesting. And it's like, all right, well, if you put out a good product that can compete, you know, with the NFL that has good games and good players and gets rid of a lot of the political silliness that we're seeing, I don't know. Maybe it is time for a change. You know, the NFL, let him try, I say.
Good enough product to compete with itself. That's the problem. The NFL's problems don't have anything to do with Kaepernick. They don't have anything to do with they have to do with the fact that the games suck. They're over-officiated. They're too long. And nobody knows what a goddamn catch is anymore. And how are you supposed to watch this? A 5-minute review every time somebody catches a ball? Jeez, get rid of that shit. Sorry, I've gone Trump on you here. So, Tim, there's one other thing I wanted to talk to you about, and that is, and this goes back to, I guess we're kind of pulling back to where we were when I said there were two topics that I thought would be interesting to get into. You are, if I had to describe you, I asked you to do it, but if I had to describe you, I would describe you as a fairly, God, now I forgot the word. True, loyal, not loyal, true, pure, ideologically pure libertarian.
Yeah, you could say that. You know, you could definitely say that. I mean, but I also don't take myself too seriously.
Right, I know you don't. But when it comes to me, and this is the problem that I've had all along with the explosion now of podcasts and shows and people on Twitter and stuff like this, there seems to be an idea that if you are not ideologically pure libertarian, you're not libertarian. You're not libertarian enough. So somebody like me, who is a paleo-conservative, originalist, I'm making up words here. I'm not making up words. I'm making up phrases. Paleo-conservative, originalist, hawk, military hawk, who, for the record, and everybody that listens to my show knows this, absolutely hates Ron Paul. If I met Ron Paul today, I would hit him and then spit on him after I knocked him down. And if I say that to a libertarian, most of them will go, well, you're not good enough for me. It doesn't matter how many libertarian beliefs I have, I'm not ideologically pure. How do we get around that? How do we get to the fact that libertarians can be black, white, green, purple, yellow, red, ideologically left, right, center, whatever? How do we beat that mentality? Because I think it's killing the libertarian movement. It's killing the libertarian party. I know that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think we have to introduce the word libertarian to more and more Americans. And I think most people are libertarian. They live their lives as libertarians. I don't bother you. You don't bother me. As long as you don't steal from me or hit me, we're fine. We get along. We can disagree on things. If I want to marry a man and you want to marry a woman, we're fine. If I smoke weed in my house, it's not going to hurt you. Most people live as libertarians. So I think we need to grow the number of people who are attracted to these principles. And when you grow it, then it will become a lot harder for the people who say you need to be X, Y, Z. It's going to be a lot harder for them to try to direct the party, and it'll become a lot more popular.
Kind of chase the rest of us off. I mean, my disdain of Ron Paul has cost me friendships. It's people who believe exactly the same thing I believe, but because I would not vote for Ron Paul because I was critical of Ron Paul, I'm the enemy. I might as well be left of Hillary Clinton for all I believe. How do we stop that nonsense? How do we say to people, look, to borrow a Republican phrase, it's a big tent.
We have to make it a bigger tent. Right now it's a tiny tent, and there's only a handful of people that are controlling it, and tend to be loud. They do tend to be relatively pure, but they don't like outsiders. It's scary. If you went to one of these libertarian party, you know, nominations or rallies or anything, some of that stuff will just scare a normal person away. So I think the party needs to reform. I think we need to get rid of some of the whack jobs. I disagree with you on Ron Paul.
I know
you do. But I don't hate you because of it. And I'm not saying you're a bad person or that you're not libertarian enough because you don't like Ron. I like Ron, but I didn't always, you know. So you know, I'm not one of those people. I think we need to elevate people who maybe are, you know, conservative or libertarian or originalist or whatever we want to call ourselves. Ultimately, we have a lot of road to go down before we're ever going to really have a strong disagreement, you know. So I think if we see things as a more long-term issue, we can kind of put the petty, who's pure enough? We can put that stuff aside for now. First, let's start traveling down the right path.
Well, that's kind of what the point I was trying to show folks here is that, as I said at the beginning, Tim and I have come to a lot of the same conclusions via different paths. I mean, there's an old saying, all rivers lead to the ocean. So I don't know how we fix that. I would love to fix it. That's what's kept me out of the Libertarian Party for all these years is the fact that, well, I have positions that disagree with the party. I mean, you can take the argument, well, you agree with 80% of it, so put up with the 20% of it. But what if the 20% is my core values? And if you're going to yell at me for my core values, why would I want to be a part of you, even if I agree with you 80% of the time?
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with the Libertarian Party, that I think the belief systems behind it work. I think they're good. They're in general, they're pretty sound. The party itself is just fractured and there's a lot of infighting and maybe it's just growing pains. I mean, maybe stuff will change. Maybe people will finally kick the two-party system, you know, in the can and get with something different.
That'd be nice.
In the meantime, though, you know, I'm happy to talk with anyone, whether they're a liberal, conservative, libertarian, whatever you want to call yourself. If we can have a civil conversation, discuss issues, find out where we agree, where we disagree, we have to start there. And that's just respecting each other. And it feels like we've made a giant, you know, a giant circle here because now we're back to what is this conversation we're seeing on Twitter and on Reddit and all of this stuff? Let's get back to real conversation.
Right, which is the whole point of all this, and it's a good. It's one of the things that Tim does very well. And so you can catch Tim's show when and where, Tim?
On iTunes, Stitcher, I mean, anywhere that you normally download a podcast, you can find the Tim Preuss podcast. You can follow me on all the social media. If you just type Tim Preuss, last name is spelled P-R-E-U-S-S, just type me into Google, and you'll find links to all of my stuff.
It's pretty easy to do, and that's also what we do here at Podcast 99. If you're one of those people that has a voice that disagrees, I would love to have left, center, right, religious, unreligious, sports. The more programming we can get here, the better off we're going to be. So if you're interested in it, drop me an email, dave@thedavebowmanshow.com, and check us out online at podcast99.org. By the way, Tim's website is preusspodcast.com, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So it's too many nets and too many other things out there. Get me confused. Tim, it's been great having you here. Looking forward to hearing the new show when it gets kicked off next week.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me on, Dave.
All right, everybody. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there, so don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. I'm Dave Bowman. That's Tim Preuss, Possibly Live. This has been the Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99
Possibly
Internet
Live
Radio
is
Network.
A Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. Contact Dave directly, call or text area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 209-565-3283. The email address is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. For more information or to hear past shows, go to www.plausiblylive.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.